Flowers for Algernon, Disc 2.
April 3rd. Finished Robinson Crusoe. I want to find out more about what happens to him, but Miss Kinnean says that's all there is. Why? April 4th. Miss Kinnean says I'm learning fast. She read some of my progress reports, and she looked at me kind of funny. She says I'm a fine person, and I'll show them all. I asked her why. She said, "Never mind, but I shouldn't feel bad if I find out that everybody isn't nice like I think." She said, "For a person who God gave so little to, you did more than a lot of people with brains they never even used." I said that all my friends are smart people, and they're good. They like me, and they never did anything that wasn't nice. Then she got something in her eye, and she had to run out to the ladies' room. While I was sitting in the teaching room waiting for her, I was wondering about how Miss Kinnean was a nice lady, like my mother used to be. I think I remember my mother told me to be good and always be friendly to people. She said, "But always be careful, because some people don't understand, and they might think you're trying to make trouble." That makes me remember when Mom had to go away, and they put me to stay in Mrs. Leroy's house, who lived next door. Mom went to the hospital. Dad said she wasn't sick or nothing, but she went to the hospital to bring me back a baby sister or a brother. I still don't know how they do that. I told them I want a baby brother to play with, and I don't know why they got me a sister instead, but she was nice, like a doll, only she cried all the time. I never hurt her or nothing. They put her in a crib in their room, and once I heard Dad say, "Don't worry, Charlie wouldn't harm her." She was like a bundle, all pink and screaming sometimes that I couldn't sleep, and when I went to sleep, she woke me up in the nighttime. One time, when they were in the kitchen and I was in my bed, she was crying. I got up to pick her up and hold her to get quiet the way Mom does. But then Mom came in yelling and took her away, and she slapped me so hard I fell on the bed. Then she started screaming, "Don't you ever touch her again! You'll hurt her! She's a baby! You got no business touching her!" I didn't know it then, but I guess I know it now, that she thought I was going to hurt the baby because I was too dumb to know what I was doing. Now that makes me feel bad, because I would never have hurt the baby. When I go to Dr. Strauss's office, I gotta tell him about that. April 6th. Today, I learned the comma. This is a comma, a period with a tail. Miss Kinnean says it's important because it makes writing better. She said somebody could lose a lot of money if a comma isn't in the right place. I got some money that I saved from my job and what the foundation pays me, but not much, and I don't see how a comma keeps you from losing it. But, she says, everybody uses commas, so I'll use them too. April 7th. I used the comma wrong. It's punctuation. Miss Kinnean told me to look up long words in the dictionary to learn to spell them. I said, "What's the difference if you can read it anyway?" She said, "It's part of your education." So from now on, I'll look up all the words I'm not sure how to spell. It takes a long time to write that way, but I think I'm remembering more and more. Anyway, that's how come I got the word punctuation right. It's that way in the dictionary. Miss Kinnean says a period is punctuation too, and there are lots of other marks to learn. I told her I thought she meant all the periods had to have tails and be called commas, but she said no. She said, "You gotta mix them up." She showed me how to mix them up, and now I can mix up all kinds of punctuation in my writing. There are lots of rules to learn, but I'm getting them in my head. One thing I like about Dear Miss Kinnean that's the way it goes in a business letter if I ever go into business, is that she always gives me a reason when I ask. She's a genius. I wish I could be smart like her. Punctuation is fun. April 8th. What a dope I am. I didn't even understand what she was talking about. I read the grammar book last night, and it explains the whole thing. Then I saw it was the same way as Miss Kinnean was trying to tell me, but I didn't get it. I got up in the middle of the night, and the whole thing straightened out in my mind. Miss Kinnean said that the TV working just before I fell asleep and during the night helped out. She said I reached a plateau. That's like the flat top of a hill. After I figured out how punctuation worked, I read over all my old progress reports from the beginning. Boy, did I have crazy spelling and punctuation. I told Miss Kinnean I ought to go over the pages and fix all the mistakes, but she said, "No, Charlie. Professor Niemer wants them just as they are. That's why he lets you keep them after they're photostatted, to see your own progress. You're coming along fast, Charlie." That made me feel good. After the lesson, I went down and played with Algernon. We don't race anymore. April 10th. I feel sick. Not like for a doctor, but inside my chest it feels empty, like getting punched and a heartburn at the same time. I wasn't going to write about it, but I guess I got to because it's important. Today was the first day I ever stayed home from work on purpose. Last night, Joe Karp and Frank Riley invited me to a party. There were lots of girls, and Gimpy was there, and Ernie, too. I remembered how sick I got last time I drank too much, so I told Joe I didn't want to drink anything. He gave me a plain Coke instead. It tasted funny, but I thought it was just a bad taste in my mouth. We had a lot of fun for a while. "Dance with Ellen," Joe said. "She'll teach you the steps." Then he winked at her like he had something in his eye. She said, "Why don't you leave him alone?" He slapped me on the back. "This is Charlie Gordon, my buddy, my pal. He's no ordinary guy. He's been promoted to working on the dough mixing machine. All I did was ask you to dance with him and give him a good time. What's wrong with that?" He pushed me up close against her. So she danced with me. I fell 3 times, and I couldn't understand why, because no one else was dancing besides Ellen and me. And all the time I was tripping because somebody's foot was always sticking out. They were all around in a circle, watching, and laughing at the way we were doing the steps. They laughed harder every time I fell, and I was laughing too because it was so funny. But the last time it happened, I didn't laugh. I picked myself up, and Joe pushed me down again. Then I saw the look on Joe's face, and it gave me a funny feeling in my stomach. "He's a scream," one of the girls said. Everybody was laughing. "Oh, you were right, Frank," choked Ellen. "He's a one-man sideshow." Then she said, "Here, Charlie, have a fruit." She gave me an apple, but when I bit into it, it was fake. Then Frank started laughing, and he said, "I told you he'd eat it. Can you imagine anyone dumb enough to eat wax fruit?" Joe said, "I ain't laughed so much since we sent him around the corner to see if it was raining that night we ditched him at Halloran's." Then I saw a picture that I remembered in my mind. When I was a kid, and the children in the block let me play with them, hide and go seek, and I was it. After I counted up to 10 over and over on my fingers, I went to look for the others. I kept looking until it got cold and dark and I had to go home. But I never found them. And I never knew why. What Frank said reminded me. That was the same thing that happened at Halloran's. And that was what Joe and the rest of them were doing. Laughing at me. And the kids playing hide-and-go-seek were playing tricks on me, and they were laughing at me, too. The people at the party were a bunch of blurred faces, all looking down and laughing at me. "Look at him, his face is red. He's blushing. Charlie's blushing. Hey, Ellen, what'd you do to Charlie? I never saw him act like this before." Boy, Ellen sure got him worked up. I didn't know what to do or where to turn. Her rubbing up against me made me feel funny. Everyone was laughing at me, and all of a sudden I felt naked. I wanted to hide myself so they wouldn't see. I ran out of the apartment. It was a large apartment house with lots of halls, and I couldn't find my way to the staircase. I forgot all about the elevator. Then, after, I found the stairs and ran out into the street and walked for a long time before I went to my room. I never knew before that Joe and Frank and the others liked to have me around just to make fun of me. Now I know what they mean when they say to pull a Charlie Gordon. I'm ashamed. And another thing. I dreamed about that girl, Ellen, dancing and rubbing up against me, and when I woke up, the sheets were wet and messy. April 13th. Still didn't go back to work at the bakery. I told Mrs. Flynn, my landlady, to call and tell Mr. Donner I'm sick. Mrs. Flynn looks at me lately like she's scared of me. I think it's a good thing about finding out how everybody laughs at me. I thought about it a lot. It's because I'm so dumb, and I don't even know when I'm doing something dumb. People think it's funny when a dumb person can't do things the same way they can. Anyway, now I know I'm getting a little smarter every day. I know punctuation, and I can spell good. I like to look up all the hard words in the dictionary, and I remember them. And I try to write these progress reports very careful, but that's hard to do. I'm reading a lot now, and Miss Kinnean says I read very fast. And I even understand a lot of the things I'm reading about, and they stay in my mind. There are times when I can close my eyes and think of a page, and it all comes back, like a picture. But other things come into my head, too. Sometimes I close my eyes and I see a clear picture. Like this morning, just after I woke up, I was laying in bed with my eyes open. It was like a big hole opened up in the walls of my mind, and I can just walk through. I think it's far back, a long time ago, when I first started working at Donner's Bakery. I see the street where the bakery is, fuzzy at first, and then it gets patchy, with some things so real they're right here, now, in front of me. And other things stay blurred, and I'm not sure. A little old man with a baby carriage made into a pushcart with a charcoal burner, and the smell of roasting chestnuts and snow on the ground. A young fellow, skinny, with wide eyes and a scared look on his face, looking up at the store sign. What does it say? Blurred letters in a way that don't make sense. I know now that the sign says Donner's Bakery, but looking back in my memory at the sign, I can't read the words through his eyes. None of the signs make sense. I think that fellow with the scared look on his face is me. Bright neon lights, Christmas trees and sidewalk peddlers, people bundled in coats with collars up and scarves around their necks. But he has no gloves. His hands are cold, and he puts down a heavy bundle of brown paper bags. He's stopping to watch the little mechanical toys that the peddler winds up. The tumbling bear, the dog jumping, the seal spinning a ball on its nose. Tumbling, jumping, spinning. If he had all those toys for himself, he would be the happiest person in the world. He wants to ask the red-faced peddler with his fingers sticking through the brown cotton gloves if he can hold the tumbling bear for a minute, but he's afraid. He picks up the bundle of paper bags and puts it on his shoulder. He's skinny, but he's strong from many years of hard work. Charlie, Charlie, Fathead Barley. Children circle around him, laughing and teasing him like little dogs snapping at his feet. Charlie smiles at them. He'd like to put down his bundle and play games with them, but when he thinks about it, the skin on his back twitches, and he feels the way the older boys throw things at him. Coming back to the bakery, he sees some boys standing in the door of a dark hallway.
Hey, look, there's Charlie. Hey, Charlie, what you got there? Want to shoot some craps? Come here, we won't hurt you.
But there's something about the doorway, the dark hall, the laughing, that makes his skin twitch again. He tries to know what it is, but all he can remember is their dirt and piss all over his clothes, and Uncle Herman shouting when he came home all covered with filth, and how Uncle Herman ran out with a hammer in his hand to find the boys who did that to him. Charlie backs away from the boys laughing in the hallway, drops the bundle, picks it up again, and runs the rest of the way to the bakery.
"What took you so long, Charlie?"
shouts Gimpy from the doorway to the back of the bakery. Charlie pushes through the swinging doors to the back of the bakery and sets down the bundle on one of the skids. He leans against the wall, shoving his hands into his pockets. He wishes he had his spinner. He likes it back here in the bakery, where the floors are white with flour, whiter than the sooty walls and ceiling. The thick soles of his own high shoes are crusted with white, and there's white in the stitching and lace eyes, and under his nails, and in the cracked, chapped skin of his hands. He relaxes here, squatting against the wall, leaning back in a way that tilts his baseball cap with the D forward over his eyes. He likes the smell of flour, sweet dough, bread and cakes and rolls baking. The oven is crackling and makes him sleepy. Sweet, warm sleep. Suddenly, falling, twisting, head hitting against the wall, someone has kicked his legs out from under him. That's all I can remember. I can see it all clearly, but I don't know why it happened. It's like when I used to go to the movies. The first time, I never understood, because they went too fast. But after I saw the picture 3 or 4 times, I used to understand what they were saying. I've got to ask Dr. Strauss about it. April 14th. Dr. Strauss says the important thing is to keep recalling memories, like the one I had yesterday, and to write them down. Then, when I come into his office, we can talk about them. Dr. Strauss is a psychiatrist and a neurosurgeon. I didn't know that. I thought he was just a plain doctor. But when I went to his office this morning, he told me about how important it is for me to learn about myself so that I can understand my problems. I said I didn't have any problems. He laughed, and then he got up from his chair and went to the window. The more intelligent you become, the more problems you'll have, Charlie. Your intellectual growth is going to outstrip your emotional growth, and I think you'll find that as you progress, there'll be many things you'll want to talk to me about. I just want you to remember that this is the place for you to come when you need help. I still don't know what it's all about, but he said, even if I don't understand my dreams or memories or why I have them, sometime in the future, they're all going to connect up, and I'll learn more about myself. He said the important thing is to find out what those people in my memories are saying. It's all about me when I was a boy, and I've got to remember what happened. I never knew about these things before. It's like, if I get intelligent enough, I'll understand all the words in my mind, and I'll know about those boys standing in the hallway, and about my Uncle Herman, and my parents. But what he means is, then I'm going to feel bad about it all, and I might get sick in my mind. So I've got to come to his office twice a week now, to talk about the things that bother me. We just sit there, and I talk, and Dr. Strauss listens. It's called therapy, and that means talking about things will make me feel better. I told him, one of the things that bothers me is about women. Like dancing with that girl, Ellen, got me all excited. So we talked about it, and I got a funny feeling while I was talking. Cold and sweaty and a buzzing inside my head, and I thought I was going to throw up. Maybe because I always thought it was dirty and bad to talk about that. But Dr. Strauss said what happened to me after the party was a wet dream, and it's a natural thing that happens to boys. So even if I'm getting intelligent and learning a lot of new things, he thinks I'm still a boy about women. It's confusing, but I'm going to find out all about my life. April 15th. I'm reading a lot these days, and almost everything is staying in my mind. Besides history and geography and arithmetic, Miss Kinnean says I should start learning foreign languages. Professor Niemer gave me some more tapes to play while I sleep. I still don't know how the conscious and unconscious mind works, but Dr. Strauss says not to worry yet. He made me promise that when I start learning college subjects in a couple of weeks, I won't read any books on psychology. That is, until he gives me permission. He says it'll confuse me and make me think about psychological theories instead of about my own ideas and feelings. But it's okay to read novels. This week, I read The Great Gatsby, An American Tragedy, and Look Homeward, Angel. I never knew about men and women doing things like that. April 16th. I feel a lot better today, but I'm still angry that all the time people were laughing and making fun of me. When I become intelligent, the way Professor Niemer says, with much more than twice my IQ of 70, then maybe people will like me and be my friends. I'm not sure what IQ is, anyway. Professor Niemer said it was something that measured how intelligent you were, like a scale in the drugstore weighs pounds. But Dr. Strauss had a big argument with him and said an IQ didn't weigh intelligence at all. He said an IQ showed how much intelligence you could get, like the numbers on the outside of a measuring cup. You still had to fill the cup up with stuff. When I asked Bert Selden, who gives me my intelligence tests and works with Algernon, he said that some people would say both of them were wrong, and according to the things he's been reading up on, the IQ measures a lot of different things, including some of the things you learned already, and it really isn't a good measure of intelligence at all. So I still don't know what IQ is, and everybody says it's something different. Mine is about 100 now, and it's going to be over 150 soon, but they still have to fill me up with the stuff. I didn't want to say anything, but I don't see how, if they don't know what it is or where it is, how they know how much of it you've got. Professor Niemer says I have to take a Rorschach test the day after tomorrow. I wonder what that is. April 17th. I had a nightmare last night, and this morning, after I woke up, I free associated, the way Dr. Strauss told me to do when I remember my dreams. Think about the dream, and just let my mind wander until other thoughts come up in my mind. I keep on doing that until my mind goes blank. Dr. Strauss says that it means I've reached a point where my subconscious is trying to block my conscious from remembering. It's a wall between the present and the past. Sometimes the wall stays up, and sometimes it breaks down, and I can remember what's behind it. Like this morning. The dream was about Miss Kinnean reading my progress reports. In the dream, I sit down to write, but I can't write or read anymore. It's all gone. I get frightened, so I ask Gimpy at the bakery to write for me. But when Miss Kinnean reads the report, she gets angry and tears the pages up, because they've got dirty words in them. When I get home, Professor Niemer and Dr. Strauss are waiting for me, and they give me a beating for writing dirty things in the progress report. When they leave me, I pick up the torn pages, but they turn into lace valentines, with blood all over them. It was a horrible dream, but I got out of bed and wrote it all down, and then I started to free associate. Bakery. Baking. The urn. Someone kicking me. Fall down. Bloody all over. Writing. Big pencil on a red valentine. A little gold heart. A locket. A chain, all covered with blood, and he's laughing at me. The chain is from a locket, spinning around, flashing the sunlight into my eyes. And I like to watch it spin, watch the chain, all bunched up and twisting and spinning. And a little girl is watching me. Her name is Harriet. Harriet, Harriet, we all love Harriet. And then there's nothing. It's blank again. Miss Kinnean reading my progress reports over my shoulder. Then we're at the adult center for the retarded, and she's reading over my shoulder as I write my compositions. School changes into PS-13, and I'm 11 years old, and Miss Kinnean is 11 years old, too. But now she's not Miss Kinnean. She's a little girl with dimples and long curls, and her name is Harriet. We all love Harriet. It's Valentine's Day. I remember. I remember what happened at PS-13 and why they had to change my school and send me to PS-222. It was because of Harriet. I see Charlie, 11 years old. He has a little gold color locket he once found in the street. There's no chain, but he has it on a string, and he likes to twirl the locket so that it bunches up the string and then watch it unwind, spinning around with the sun flicking into his eyes. Sometimes, when the kids play catch, they let him play in the middle, and he tries to get the ball before one of them catches it. He likes to be in the middle, even if he never catches the ball. And once, when Jaime Roth dropped the ball by mistake and he picked it up, they wouldn't let him throw it. But he had to go in the middle again. When Harriet passes by, the boys stop playing and look at her. All the boys love Harriet. When she shakes her head, her curls bounce up and down, and she has dimples. Charlie doesn't know why they make such a fuss about a girl, and why they always want to talk to her. He'd rather play ball or kick the can or ringolivio than talk to a girl. But all the boys are in love with Harriet, so he's in love with her too. She never teases him like the other kids, and he does tricks for her. He walks on the desks when the teacher isn't there. He throws erasers out the window, scribbles all over the blackboard and walls. And Harriet always screeches and giggles. Oh, look at Charlie, ain't he funny? Oh, ain't he silly? It's Valentine's Day, and the boys are talking about Valentines they're going to give Harriet. So Charlie says, I'm going to give Harriet a Valentine, too. They laugh, and Barry says, Where are you going to get a valentine? I'm going to get her a pretty one. You'll see. But he doesn't have any money for a valentine, so he decides to give Harriet his locket that is heart-shaped like the valentines in the store windows. That night, he takes tissue paper from his mother's drawer, and it takes a long time to wrap and tie it with a piece of red ribbon. Then he takes it to Jaime Roth the next day during lunch period in school and asks Jaime to write on the paper for him. He tells Jaime to write, Dear Harriet, I think you are the most prettiest girl in the whole world. I like you very much and I love you. I want you to be my valentine. Your friend, Charlie Gordon. Jaime prints very carefully in large letters on the paper, laughing all the time. And he tells Charlie, Boy, this'll knock her eyes out. Wait till she sees this. Charlie is scared, but he wants to give Harriet that locket. So he follows her home from school and waits until she goes into her house. Then he sneaks into the hall and hangs the package on the inside of the doorknob. He rings the bell twice and runs across the street to hide behind the tree. When Harriet comes down, she looks around to see who rang the bell. Then she sees the package. She takes it and goes upstairs. Charlie goes home from school, and he gets a spanking because he took the tissue paper and ribbon out of his mother's drawer without telling her. But he doesn't care. Tomorrow, Harriet will wear the locket and tell all the boys he gave it to her. Then they'll see. The next day he runs all the way to school, but it's too early. Harriet isn't there yet, and he's excited. But when Harriet comes in, she doesn't even look at him. She isn't wearing the locket, and she looks sore. He does all kinds of things when Mrs. Jansen isn't watching. He makes funny faces. He laughs out loud. He stands up on his seat and wiggles his fanny. He even throws a piece of chalk at Harold. But Harriet doesn't look at him even once. Maybe she forgot. Maybe she'll wear it tomorrow. She passes by in the hallway, but when he comes over to ask her, she pushes past him without saying a word. Down in the schoolyard, her two big brothers are waiting for him. Gus pushes him. "You little bastard. Did you write this dirty note to my sister?" Charlie says he didn't write any dirty notes. "I just gave her a valentine." Oscar, who was on the football team before he graduated from high school, grabs Charlie's shirt and tears off two buttons. "You keep away from my kid's sister, you degenerate. You don't belong in this school anyway." He pushes Charlie over to Gus, who catches him by the throat. Charlie is scared and starts to cry. Then they start to hurt him. Oscar punches him in the nose, and Gus knocks him on the ground and kicks him in the side, and then both of them kick him, one and then the other. And some of the other kids in the yard, Charlie's friends, come running, screaming, and clapping hands. "Fight! Fight! They're beating up Charlie!" His clothes are torn, and his nose is bleeding, and one of his teeth is broken. And after Gus and Oscar go away, he sits on the sidewalk and cries. The blood tastes sour. The other kids just laugh and shout, "Charlie got a licking! Charlie got a licking!" And then Mr. Wagner, one of the caretakers from the school, comes and chases them away. He takes Charlie into the boys' room and tells him to wash off the blood and dirt from his face and hands before he goes back home. I guess I was pretty dumb, because I believed what people told me. I shouldn't have trusted Jaime, or anyone. I never remembered any of this before today, but it came back to me after I thought about the dream. It has something to do with the feeling about Miss Kinney and reading my progress reports. Anyway, I'm glad now I don't have to ask anyone to write things for me. Now I can do it for myself. But I just realized something. Harriet never gave me back my locket. April 18th. I found out what a Rorschach is. It's the test with the ink blots, the one I took before the operation. As soon as I saw what it was, I got frightened. I knew Bert was going to ask me to find the pictures, and I knew I wouldn't be able to. I was thinking, if only there was some way of knowing what kind of pictures were hidden there. Maybe there weren't any pictures at all. Maybe it was just a trick to see if I was dumb enough to look for something that wasn't there. Just thinking about it made me sore at him. "All right, Charlie," he said. "You've seen these cards before, remember?" "Of course I remember." The way I said it, he knew I was angry, and he looked up at me, surprised. "Anything wrong, Charlie?" "No, nothing's wrong. Those ink blots upset me." He smiled and shook his head. "Nothing to be upset about. This is just one of the standard personality tests. Now, I want you to look at this card. What might this be? What do you see on this card? People see all sorts of things in these ink blots. Tell me what it might be for you, what it makes you think of." I was shocked. I stared at the card, and then at him. That wasn't what I had expected him to say at all. "You mean, there are no pictures hidden in those ink blots?" Bert frowned and took off his glasses. "What? Pictures, hidden in the ink blots. Last time you told me that everyone could see them and you wanted me to find them too." "No, Charlie, I couldn't have said that." "What do you mean?" I shouted at him. Being so afraid of the inkblots had made me angry at myself and at Bert, too. That's what you said to me. Just because you're smart enough to go to college doesn't mean you have to make fun of me. I'm sick and tired of everybody laughing at me. I don't recall ever being so angry before. I don't think it was at Bert himself, but suddenly everything exploded. I tossed the Rorschach cards on the table and walked out. Professor Niemer was passing by in the hall, and when I rushed past him without saying hello, he knew something was wrong. He and Bert caught up with me as I was about to go down in the elevator. "Charlie," said Niemer, grabbing my arm. "Wait a minute. What is this all about?" I shook free and nodded at Bert. "I'm sick and tired of people making fun of me, that's all. Maybe before I didn't know any better, but now I do, and I don't like it."
"Nobody's making fun of you here, Charlie," said Niemer.
"What about the ink blots? Last time Bert told me there were pictures in the ink that everyone could see, and I..."
"Look, Charlie, would you like to hear the exact words Bert said to you and your answers as well? We have a tape recording of that testing session. We can replay it and let you hear exactly what was said."
I went back with them to the psych office with mixed feelings. I was sure they had made fun of me and tricked me when I was too ignorant to know better. My anger was an exciting feeling, and I didn't give it up easily. I was ready to fight. As Niemer went to the files to get the tape, Bert explained, "Last time, I used almost the exact words I used today. It's a requirement of these tests that the procedure be the same each time it's administered."
"I'll believe that when I hear it." A look passed between them. I felt the blood rush to my face again. They were laughing at me.
But then I realized what I had just said, and hearing myself, I understood the reason for the look. They weren't laughing. They knew what was happening to me. I had reached a new level, and anger and suspicion were my first reactions to the world around me.
Bert's voice boomed over the tape recorder.
"Now I want you to look at this card, Charlie. What might this be? What do you see on this card? People see all kinds of things in these inkblots. Tell me what it makes you think of."
The same words, almost the same tone of voice he had used minutes ago in the lab. And then I heard my answers. Childish, impossible things. And I dropped limply into the chair beside Professor Niemer's desk. Was that really me? I went back to the lab with Bert, and we went on with the Rorschach. We went through the cards slowly. This time my responses were different. I saw things in the inkblots. A pair of bats tugging at each other. Two men fencing with swords. I imagined all sorts of things. But even so, I found myself not trusting Bert completely anymore. I kept turning the cards around, checking the backs to see if there was anything there I was supposed to catch. I peeked while he was making his notes, but it was all in code that looked like this. WF plus A, DDF dash AD, ORIG period. WF dash ASF plus OBJ. The test still doesn't make sense. It seems to me that anyone could make up lies about things he didn't really see. How could they know I wasn't making fools of them by saying things I didn't really imagine? Maybe I'll understand it when Dr. Strauss lets me read up on psychology. It's getting harder for me to write down all my thoughts and feelings because I know that people are reading them. Maybe it would be better if I could keep some of these reports private for a while. I'm going to ask Dr. Strauss. Why should it suddenly start to bother me?
Progress Report 10. April 21st.
I figured out a new way to set up the mixing machines in the bakery to speed up production. Mr. Donner says he will save labor costs and increase profits. He gave me a $50 bonus and a $10 a week raise. I wanted to take Joe Karp and Frank Riley out to lunch to celebrate, but Joe had to buy some things for his wife and Frank was meeting his cousin for lunch. I guess it'll take time for them to get used to the changes in me. Everyone seems frightened of me. When I went over to Gimpy and tapped him on the shoulder to ask him something, he jumped up and dropped his cup of coffee all over himself. He stares at me when he thinks I'm not looking. Nobody at the place talks to me anymore, or kids around the way they used to. It makes the job kind of lonely. Thinking about it makes me remember the time I fell asleep standing up, and Frank kicked my legs out from under me. The warm, sweet smell, the white walls, the roar of the oven when Frank opens the door to shift the loaves. Suddenly falling, twisting, everything out from under me and my head cracking against the wall. It's me, and yet it's like someone else lying there, another Charlie. He's confused, rubbing his head, staring up at Frank, tall and thin, and then at Gimpy nearby, massive, hairy, gray-faced Gimpy with bushy eyebrows that almost hide his blue eyes.
"Leave the kid alone," says Gimp. "Jesus, Frank, why do you always gotta pick on him?"
"It don't mean nothing," laughs Frank. "It don't hurt him. He don't know any better. Do you, Charlie?"
Charlie rubs his head and cringes. He doesn't know what he's done to deserve this punishment, but there's always the chance that there will be more.
"But you know better," says Gimpy, clumping over on his orthopedic boot. "So what the hell are you always picking on him for?"
The two men sit down at the long table, the tall Frank and the heavy Gimp shaping the dough for the rolls that have to be baked for the evening orders. They work in silence for a while, and then Frank stops and tips his white cap back.
"Hey, Gimp, think Charlie could learn to bake rolls?"
Gimp leans an elbow on the work table.
"Why don't we just leave him alone?"
"No, I mean it, Gimp, seriously. I bet he could learn something simple, like making rolls."
The idea seems to appeal to Gimpy, who turns to stare at Charlie.
"Maybe you got something there. Hey, Charlie, come here a minute."
As he usually does when people are talking about him, Charlie has been keeping his head down, staring at his shoelaces. He knows how to lace and tie them. He could make rolls. He could learn to pound, roll, twist, and shape the dough into the small round forms. Frank looks at him uncertainly.
"Maybe we shouldn't, Gimp. Maybe it's wrong. If a moron can't learn, maybe we shouldn't start anything with him."
"You leave this to me," says Gimpy, who has now taken over Frank's idea. "I think maybe he can learn. Now listen, Charlie. You want to learn something? You want me to teach you how to make rolls like me and Frank are doing?"
Charlie stares at him, the smile melting from his face. He understands what Gimpy wants, and he feels cornered. He wants to please Gimpy, but there is something about the words learn and teach, something to remember about being punished severely. But he doesn't recall what it is. Only a thin white hand upraised, hitting him to make him learn something he couldn't understand. Charlie backs away, but Gimpy grabs his arm.
"Hey, kid, take it easy. We ain't gonna hurt you. Look at him shaking like he's gonna fall apart. Look, Charlie, I got a nice new shiny good luck piece for you to play with."
He holds out his hand and reveals a brass chain with a shiny brass disc that says Stay-Brite Metal Polish. He holds the chain by one end, and the gleaming gold disc rotates slowly, catching the light of the fluorescent bulbs. The pendant is a brightness that Charlie remembers, but he doesn't know why or what. He doesn't reach for it. He knows you get punished if you reach out for other people's things. If someone puts it into your hand, that's all right, but otherwise it's wrong. When he sees that Gimpy is offering it to him, he nods and smiles again.
"That he knows," laughs Frank. "Give him something bright and shiny."
Frank, who has let Gimpy take over the experiment, leans forward excitedly.
Maybe, if he wants that piece of junk bad enough, and you tell him he'll get it if he learns to shape the dough into rolls, maybe it'll work.
As the bakers set to the task of teaching Charlie, others from the shop gather around. Frank clears an area between them on the table, and Gimpy pulls off a medium-sized piece of dough for Charlie to work with. There is talk of betting on whether or not Charlie can learn to make rolls.
"Watch us carefully," says Gimpy, putting the pendant beside him on the table where Charlie can see it. "Watch and do everything we do. If you learn how to make rolls, you get this shiny good luck piece."
Charlie hunches over on his stool, intently watching Gimpy pick up the knife and cut off a slab of dough. He studies each movement as Gimpy rolls out the dough into a long roll, breaks it off, and twists it into a circle, pausing now and then to sprinkle it with flour.
"Now watch me," says Frank, and he repeats Gimpy's performance.
Charlie is confused. There are differences. Gimpy holds his elbows out as he rolls the dough, like a bird's wings, but Frank keeps his arms close to his sides. Gimpy keeps his thumbs together with the rest of his fingers as he kneads the dough, but Frank works with the flat of his palms, keeping thumbs apart from his other fingers and up in the air. Worrying about these things makes it impossible for Charlie to move when Gimpy says,
"Go ahead, try it."
Charlie shakes his head.
"Look, Charlie, I'm going to do it again slow. Now you watch everything I do and do each part along with me, okay? But try to remember everything, so then you'll be able to do the whole thing alone. Now come on, like this."
Charlie frowns as he watches Gimpy pull off a section of dough and roll it into a ball. He hesitates, but then he picks up the knife and slices off a piece of dough and sets it down in the center of the table. Slowly, keeping his elbows out exactly as Gimpy does, he rolls it into a ball. He looks from his own hands to Gimpy's, and he's careful to keep his fingers exactly the same way, thumbs together with the rest of his fingers, slightly cupped. He has to do it right, the way Gimpy wants him to do it. There are echoes inside him that say, "Do it right, and they will like you." And he wants Gimpy and Frank to like him. When Gimpy has finished working his dough into a ball, he stands back, and so does Charlie.
"Hey, that's great. Look, Frank, he made it into a ball."
Frank nods and smiles. Charlie sighs, and his whole frame trembles as the tension builds. He is unaccustomed to this rare moment of success.
"All right now," says Gimpy. "Now we make a roll."
Awkwardly but carefully, Charlie follows Gimpy's every move. Occasionally, a twitch of his hand or arm mars what he's doing, but in a little while, he's able to twist off a section of the dough and fashion it into a roll. Working beside Gimpy, he makes 6 rolls, and sprinkling them with flour, he sets them carefully alongside Gimpy's in the large flour-covered tray.
"All right, Charlie."
Gimpy's face is serious.
"Now let's see you do it by yourself. Remember all the things you did from the beginning. Now go ahead."
Charlie stares at the huge slab of dough and at the knife that Gimpy has pushed into his hand. And once again, panic comes over him. What did he do first? How did he hold his hand, his fingers? Which way did he roll the ball? 1,000 confusing ideas burst into his mind at the same time, and he stands there, smiling. He wants to do it, to make Frank and Gimpy happy and have them like him, and to get the bright good luck piece that Gimpy has promised him. He turns the smooth, heavy piece of dough around and around on the table, but he cannot bring himself to start. He cannot cut into it because he knows he will fail, and he's afraid.
"He forgot already," said Frank. "It don't stick."
He wants it to stick. He frowns and tries to remember. "First, you start to cut off a piece. Then you roll it out into a ball. But how does it get to be a roll like the ones in the tray? That's something else. Give him time and he'll remember. As soon as the fuzziness passes away, he'll remember. Just another few seconds and he'll have it. He wants to hold on to what he's learned for a little while. He wants it so much.
Okay, Charlie, sighs Gimpy, taking the cutter out of his hand. That's all right, don't worry about it. It's not your work anyway.
Another minute and he'll remember. If only they wouldn't rush him. Why does everything have to be in such a hurry?
Go ahead, Charlie. Go sit down and look at your comic book. We gotta get back to work.
Charlie nods and smiles and pulls the comic book out of his back pocket. He smooths it out and puts it on his head as a make-believe hat. Frank laughs, and Gimpy finally smiles.
Go on, you big baby,
snorts Gimpy.
Go sit down there until Mr. Donna wants you.
Charlie smiles at him and goes back to the flour sacks in the corner near the mixing machines. He likes to lean back against them while he sits on the floor cross-legged and looks at the pictures in his comic book. As he starts to turn the pages, he feels like crying, but he doesn't know why. What is there to feel sad about? The fuzzy cloud comes and goes, and now he looks forward to the pleasure of the brightly colored pictures in the comic book that he has gone through 30, 40 times. He knows all of the figures in the comic. He has asked their names over and over again of almost everyone he meets, and he understands that the strange forms of letters and words in the white balloons above the figures means that they are saying something. Would he ever learn to read what was in the balloons? If they gave him enough time, if they didn't rush him or push him too fast, he would get it. But nobody has time. Charlie pulls his legs up and opens the comic book to the first page, where Batman and Robin are swinging up a long rope to the side of a building. Someday, he decides, he is going to read. And then he will be able to read the story. He feels a hand on his shoulder, and he looks up. It's Gimpy, holding out the brass disc and chain, letting it swing and twirl around so that it catches the light.
Here,
he says gruffly, tossing it into Charlie's lap. And then he limps away.
I never thought about it before, but that was a nice thing for him to do. Why did he?
Anyway, that's my memory of the time, clearer and more complete than anything I have ever experienced before. Like looking out of the kitchen window early, when the morning light is still gray. I've come a long way since then, and I owe it all to Dr. Strauss and Professor Niemer and the other people here at Beekman. But what must Frank and Gimpy think and feel now, seeing how I've changed? April 22nd. People at the bakery are changing. Not only ignoring me, I can feel the hostility. Donner is arranging for me to join the baker's union, and I've gotten another raise. The rotten thing is that all of the pleasure is gone because the others resent me. In a way, I can't blame them. They don't understand what has happened to me, and I can't tell them. People aren't proud of me the way I expected. Not at all. Still, I've got to have someone to talk to. I'm going to ask Miss Kinnean to go to a movie tomorrow night to celebrate my raise, if I can get up the nerve. April 24th. Professor Niemer finally agreed with Dr. Strauss and me that it will be impossible for me to write down everything if I know it's immediately read by people at the lab. I've tried to be completely honest about everything, no matter who I was talking about, but there are things I can't put down unless I can keep them private, at least for a while. Now, I'm allowed to keep back some of these more personal reports, but before the final report to the Wellberg Foundation, Professor Niemer will read through everything to decide what part of it should be published. What happened today at the lab was very upsetting. I dropped by the office earlier this evening to ask Dr. Strauss or Professor Niemer if they thought it would be all right for me to ask Alice Kinnean out to a movie,
But before I could knock, I heard them arguing with each other. I shouldn't have stayed, but it's hard to break the habit of listening, because people have always spoken and acted as if I weren't there, as if they never cared what I overheard. I heard someone bang on the desk, and then Professor Niemer shouted, "I've already informed the convention committee that we will present the paper at Chicago." Then I heard Dr. Strauss's voice. "But you're wrong, Harold. 6 weeks from now is still too soon. He's still changing." And then Niemer. "We've predicted the pattern correctly so far. We're justified in making an interim report. I tell you, Jay, there's nothing to be afraid of. We've succeeded. It's all positive. Nothing can go wrong now." Strauss. "This is too important to all of us to bring it out into the open prematurely. You're taking the authority on yourself." Niemer. "You forget that I'm the senior member of this project." Strauss. "And you forget that you're not the only one with a reputation to consider. If we claim too much now, our whole hypothesis will come under fire." Niemer. "I'm not afraid of regression anymore. I've checked and rechecked everything. An interim report will do no harm. I feel sure nothing can go wrong now." The argument went on that way, with Strauss saying that Niemer had his eye on the chair of psychology at Halston, and Niemer saying that Strauss was riding on the coattails of his psychological research. Then Strauss said that the project had as much to do with his techniques in psychosurgery and enzyme injection patterns as with Niemer's theories, and that someday thousands of neurosurgeons all over the world would be using his methods. But at this point, Niemer reminded him that those new techniques would never have come about if not for his original theory. They called each other names, opportunist, cynic, pessimist, and I found myself frightened. Suddenly, I realized I no longer had the right to stand there outside the office and listen to them without their knowing it. They might not have cared when I was too feeble-minded to know what was going on, but now that I could understand, they wouldn't want me to hear it. I left without waiting for the outcome. It was dark, and I walked for a long time, trying to figure out why I was so frightened. I was seeing them clearly for the first time. Not gods or even heroes, but just two men worried about getting something out of their work. Yet, if Niemer is right, and the experiment is a success, what does it matter? There's so much to do, so many plans to make. I'll wait until tomorrow to ask them about taking Miss Kinnean to a movie to celebrate my raise. April 26th. I know I shouldn't hang around the college when I'm through at the lab, but seeing the young men and women going back and forth carrying books and hearing them talk about all the things they're learning in their classes excites me. I wish I could sit and talk with them over coffee in the campus bowl luncheonette when they get together to argue about books and politics and ideas. It's exciting to hear them talking about poetry and science and philosophy, about Shakespeare and Milton, Newton and Einstein and Freud, about Plato and Hegel and Kant and all the other names that echo like great church bells in my mind. Sometimes I listen in on the conversations at the tables around me, and pretend I'm a college student, even though I'm a lot older than they are. I carry books around, and I've started to smoke a pipe. It's silly, but since I belong at the lab, I feel as if I'm a part of the university. I hate to go home to that lonely room. April 27th. I've made friends with some of the boys at the campus bowl. They were arguing about whether or not Shakespeare really wrote Shakespeare's plays. One of the boys, the fat one with the sweaty face, said that Marlowe wrote all of Shakespeare's plays. But Lenny, the short kid with the dark glasses, didn't believe that business about Marlowe, and he said that everyone knew that Sir Francis Bacon wrote the plays, because Shakespeare had never been to college and never had the education that shows up in those plays. That's when the one with the freshman beanie said he had heard a couple of guys in the men's room talking about how Shakespeare's plays were really written by a lady. And they talked about politics and art and God. I never before heard anyone say that there might not be a God. That frightened me, because for the first time, I began to think about what God means. Now I understand one of the important reasons for going to college and getting an education is to learn that the things you've believed in all your life aren't true, and that nothing is what it appears to be. All the time they talked and argued, I felt the excitement bubble up inside me. This was what I wanted to do. Go to college and hear people talk about important things. I spend most of my free time at the library now, reading and soaking up what I can from books. I'm not concentrating on anything in particular, just reading a lot of fiction now. Dostoevsky, Flaubert, Dickens, Hemingway, Faulkner, everything I can get my hands on. Feeding a hunger that can't be satisfied. April 28th. In a dream last night, I heard Mom screaming at Dad and the teacher at the elementary school PS-13, my first school before they transferred me to PS-222. He's normal! He's normal! He'll grow up like other people, better than others! She was trying to scratch the teacher, but Dad was holding her back. He'll go to college someday! He'll be somebody! She kept screaming it, clawing at Dad so that he'd let go of her. He'll go to college someday, and he'll be somebody! We were in the principal's office, and there were a lot of people looking embarrassed, but the assistant principal was smiling and turning his head so no one would see it. The principal in my dream had a long beard and was floating around the room and pointing at me. He'll have to go to a special school.
Put him into the Warren State Home and Training School. We can't have him here.
Dad was pulling Mom out of the principal's office, and she was shouting and crying, too. I didn't see her face, but her big red teardrops kept splashing down on me. This morning I could recall the dream, but now there's more than that. I can remember through the blur, back to when I was 6 years old and it all happened, just before Norma was born. I see Mom, a thin, dark-haired woman who talks too fast and uses her hands too much. As always, her face is blurred. Her hair is up in a bun, and her hand goes to touch it, pat it smooth, as if she has to make sure it's still there. I remember that she was always fluttering like a big white bird around my father, and he too heavy and tired to escape her pecking. I see Charlie, standing in the center of the kitchen, playing with his spinner, bright-colored beads and rings threaded on a string. He holds the string up in one hand, turns the rings so they wind and unwind in bright spinning flashes. He spends long hours watching his spinner. I don't know who made it for him or what became of it, but I see him standing there fascinated as the string untwists and sets the rings spinning. She is screaming at him. No, she's screaming at his father. I'm not gonna take him! There's nothing wrong with him!
Rose, it won't do any good pretending any longer that nothing is wrong. Just look at him, Rose. 6 years old, and
he's not a dummy. He's normal. He'll be just like everyone else.
He looks sadly at his son with the spinner, and Charlie smiles and holds it up to show him how pretty it is when it goes around and around.
Put that thing away!
Mom shrieks, and suddenly she knocks the spinner from Charlie's hand, and it crashes across the kitchen floor.
Go play with your alphabet blocks!
He stands there, frightened by the sudden outburst. He cowers, not knowing what she'll do. His body begins to shake. They're arguing, and the voices back and forth make a squeezing pressure inside him, and a sense of panic.
Charlie, go to the bathroom! Don't you dare do it in your pants!
He wants to obey her, but his legs are too soft to move. His arms go up automatically to ward off blows.
For God's sake, Rose, leave him alone. You've got him terrified. You always do this, and the poor kid...
Then why don't you help me? I have to do it all by myself. Every day I try to teach him, to help him catch up to the others. He's just slow, that's all. But he can learn like everyone else.
You're fooling yourself, Rose. It's not fair to us or to him, pretending he's normal, driving him as if he were an animal that could learn to do tricks. Why don't you just leave him alone? Because I want him to be like everyone else. As they argue, the feeling that grips Charlie's insides becomes greater. His bowels feel as if they will burst, and he knows he should go to the bathroom, as she has told him so often. But he can't walk. He feels like sitting down right there in the kitchen, but it's wrong, and she'll slap him. He wants his spinner. If he has his spinner and he watches it going round and round, he will be able to control himself and not make in his pants. But the spinner is all apart, with some of the rings under the table and some under the sink, and the cord is near the stove. It is very strange that, although I can recall the voices clearly, their faces are still blurred, and I can see only general outlines. Dad massive and slumped, Mom thin and quick. Hearing them now, arguing with each other across the years, I have the impulse to shout at them, "Look at him! There, down there, look at Charlie! He has to go to the toilet!" Charlie stands clutching and pulling at his red checkered shirt as they argue over him. The words are angry sparks between them, an anger and a guilt he can't identify.
Next September, he's going to go back to PS-13 and do the term's work over again.
Why can't you let yourself see the truth? The teacher says he's not capable of doing the work in a regular class.
That bitch a teacher?
Oh, I've got better names for her. Let us start with me again, and I'll do more than just write to the Board of Education. I'll scratch that dirty slut's eyes out.
Charlie, why are you twisting like that? Go to the bathroom.
Go by yourself. You know how to go. Can't you see he wants you to take him? He's frightened.
Keep out of this. He's perfectly capable of going to the bathroom himself. The book says it gives him confidence and a feeling of achievement.
The terror that waits in that cold tile room overwhelms him. He's afraid to go there alone. He reaches up for her hand and sobs out,
"Toy, toy,"
and she slaps his hand away.
"No more," she says sternly. "You're a big boy now. You can go by yourself. Now march right into that bathroom and pull your pants down the way I taught you. I warn you, if you make in your pants, you'll get spanked."
I can almost feel it now, the stretching and knotting in his intestines, as the two of them stand over him, waiting to see what he will do. His whimper becomes a soft crying, as suddenly he can control no longer, and he sobs and covers his face with his hands as he dirties himself. It is soft and warm, and he feels the confusion of relief and fear. It is his, but she will take it away from him as she always does. She will take it away and keep it for herself, and she'll spank him. She comes toward him, screaming that he is a bad boy, and Charlie runs to his father for help. Suddenly, I remember that her name is Rose, and his name is Matt. It's odd to have forgotten your parents' names. And what about Norma? Strange, I haven't thought about them all for a long time. I wish I could see Matt's face now, to know what he was thinking at that moment. All I remember is that as she began to spank me, Matt Gordon turned and walked out of the apartment. I wish I could see their faces more clearly.
This ends Disc 2.